In this session on pagan religions, there'll be a lot of review, so maybe I can go through this more quickly. But what I want to do is I want us to get big picture, not so much get all the details of all these various religions, because it can get very complicated. But let me ask you to think about this question and talk to the person next to you to begin. What's the key reason we see so many religions in the world? Why is it that we have so many religions? I mean, if there is a one true God, why is it not just obvious that we would all worship Him? Why are there such divergent beliefs, since we all have the same biological source in Adam and Eve, you know? Did it just show up there? But it stopped. It didn't. It went off? I've given you guys actually have on your computers, you have access to this projector. So I have the power here to turn all of your computers off the access to the projector. But I'm not exercising this power, you understand? But if you give the power back to me, then I'll put my slides up on the screen, you know. But here's a question I want you to, until that happens. Here's a question I want you to you just think of it. You don't have it up here. Why do we have so many different religions in the world? Why? All right. Well, talk to the person next to you and answer that question. Why do we have so many different religions in the world? All right. Let me give you a couple minutes to address that. If you're listening on the website, it's a good question for you to think about as well. What would be the reason that we have so many religions? You can even write it out. If you're following in the notes, you can write it out in the notes section on the PowerPoint. Wow, friends, it's really great to see everybody talking like this. I hate to interrupt you. You know, I mean, I'm sure you're hearing some good thoughts from the person next to you. Any of you want to quote someone you talked to that you heard a good insight? You would like to quote John?
You made a very quotable quote.
What was John's? What's John's quote?
Jonathan Lim said this. He said, "People like to make God in their own image."
Okay, we have a lot of different religions because people like to make God in their own image, and all of us are so different.
As opposed to recognizing that we are made in God's image.
Ah, okay. So if we make gods in our image, and all of us are so different, then we're going to have all kinds of different gods. Interesting thought. By the way, have you noticed in that regard, John, that none of our movies ever say written by or script writer and all that? All the newer movies, it always says at the beginning, created by. Have you noticed that?
Nope.
Have you noticed that that we don't have... We don't have people talking about God's creation when they're outside, when they're looking at beautiful trees, etc. People don't refer to this as God's creation. We refer to it as nature, or even worse, Mother Nature. So if we're going to put any kind of personality, personal being behind the creation that we see, we put a feminine, you know, prefix to it. There are many of these teachings going on saying, just like you're saying, that God did not create us, we created him. We created him in our image. So, good thought. Other ideas on this?
When I was saying sin entered into the world, caused separation, and
okay, when sin enters the world, then our focus... And the reason we are sinful is because we're focusing on ourselves rather than God?
Because of the sin, right?
Yeah, and because of our sin.
More self-deterministic, they start to think and start to create a certain kind of God image that's in their image and not in God's image.
The fact that we have all these various gods that are created by us does put us in charge, doesn't it? Because there are no other gods who are revealing themselves. It's not like there's a competition between these gods who's going to actually reveal himself better to people. I don't mean to say there's no demonic sources, because I think, well, the Bible says Satan is the father of lies, and one of the biggest lies is that these demons are portraying themselves as gods, even as Satan did. So we need to not be so naive to think that there's not a demonic influence between, and all these various depictions of God. I say that because 1 Corinthians 10 says, those who sacrifice to these other gods sacrifice to demons. That's not a very politically correct statement. That's not a very religiously correct statement to say such a thing. But that's exactly what Paul's view was of sacrifice in the pagan world in which he lived. And he's writing Corinth. They were involved in the Corinthian mystery religions and all kinds of issues there going on in Corinth. But yeah, good thoughts. Others?
We discussed about it is easy to create something out of what is visible, rather than believing something what is invisible. For example, God. Why initially
okay,
they came up with a lot of gods? Because sun is visible, so sun gives energy.
Okay.
It became.
So we create gods based on what we see.
Yes.
Because nobody actually has created another god that is like the god that we worship, right?
Yeah.
Nobody said, oh, that's not, the Christian God is not the true God. He's another God, but he's also omniscient, omnipotent, loves us immensely, but his name is not, you know, the name the Christians would give him, any of these many multitude of names.
Yeah, if something is not I mean, visible, for example, again, going back to Hindus, they believe in the supreme power, something called Maya. Because the power, which is not visible, but it has a lot of power to rule everything.
Now, is Maya in Hinduism basically what the Westerners would call the Force?
Yes.
So Star Wars has taken Hinduism and basically taken the Maya concept and said, oh, the Force can be good or bad.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't know what you guys think of Star Wars, but that whole movie has just flooded the Western world with Hindu thought. And so I think you certainly shouldn't watch it without really thinking about it and talking it through and what kind of theology it's actually giving us. Good. Any thoughts on this side of the class or... Let me say it this way. Do we have so many gods because we're just ignorant of the true God? Is the problem ignorance?
No.
Many people say our problem is ignorance. So therefore, we need to go,
I think T said...
What do you think? What do you think, T? Is it ignorance?
I think hardly, because I think it's something in us, like, reminds us that there's God, but they just ignore it and then find out.
We're actually ignoring what God has put in us.
And also out of curiosity of knowing things which we really don't understand. For example, Greeks.
We create these religions out of curiosity.
Also.
A lot of times it could be power, right? If you create a religion and you're deemed to be the one who knows about that religion, then there's a certain sense of esteem and power that comes your way. Yeah. This is the cult idea.
Yep.
One thing we find among cults is that they all have a centralized leadership and a person who has a fair amount of power over other people. So
I think that we can be also out of ignorance and fear, because we do know there is a God, but which God? Mm-hmm. Because there is a loss in transmission, right?
Okay.
So then when I see thunder and I get frightened because of the thunder, like,
so we create gods out of fear as well.
Yeah.
We realize that there are things that are more powerful than us.
Mm-hmm.
Lightning, thunder.
Yeah. And then so just bow down and say, oh, God of sky or whatever. Then after that, somebody else, brilliant idea come up.
Yeah. I remember praying to the God of rain when I was a young boy.
Really?
Before I was a Christian, my brother and I, we'd get in the tent. We were out there to go skiing, on a holiday, on vacation. We had the boat and we had the water skis and it was all raining down. And so my brother and I would say, oh God, may a mighty rain God, please stop the thunder, please stop the rain. It was my brother and me. I was about 7 years old, I guess. He was 9 years old. I didn't know what God to pray to. I mean, I had no idea. But I knew that the Native Americans were praying to these different gods of different, they were different, powerful in these different ways. In some ways we were praying, other ways we were just sort of smirking and joking and laughing and trying to pass time while the storm was going. And my brother and I didn't have anything to do but goof off in our little tent, until the rain passed. None of you have mentioned Romans 1. Maybe you've had it, maybe you've mentioned it in some sense. But Romans 1:20 is a very key verse in relationship to the pagan religions of the world. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, and he talks about two of those, his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. I don't think we think about this verse that much. Now, you've heard that all men are without excuse because we look at creation, right? But look what's in the middle. What is it that we actually observe in creation? What are these invisible qualities of God that we all know about? There's two of them that Paul mentions specifically that everybody, man, woman, child, everybody in the world actually knows about, innately knows about God. His eternal power. So we know there is a single God who is more powerful than all other gods. And we also know the divine nature. You ever thought about what that means? What does that mean? That there is God has a divine nature. Well, of course he has a good divine nature. He's God. The nature of the divine is divine, right? But what does that mean? I think in our hearts, we all know that there is one who is limitless. We recognize that as humans, we have a certain level of power. We can make so many choices in our lives. Some of us are more powerful than others. Every one of us is more powerful than somebody. You may feel powerless, you know, when you're in school, but there's a person who's limitless, and there's also a person who's supernatural. And what does supernatural mean? Above that which is natural. Right? What is natural? What is natural about us? We are created. We have a nature to us, right? We have a human nature. That implies personality, does it not? So would it not make sense in the human heart for everybody that the one who is above us, who has created this whole world, has eternal power, but he also has a nature like us, but far greater than us? I say that because isn't it silly to think that God doesn't have personality? Because that which has personality is superior to that which does not have personality. I'm assuming you agree with my assumption there. That's where assumptions go. I have personality, so I'm greater than this folder here. This folder doesn't have personality. It cannot make decisions. It goes where I go, or it stays where I want it to go. There's no will. But I am greater than that. How silly for us to think that God doesn't have personality, that there's no divine nature to God. Okay, your thoughts? Any thoughts about this? Right? Yeah.
So I think we can all agree that most people have the recognition of a divine, like from nature.
Yeah, most people are theists. You find very few that are atheists.
Except by choice. But then the question is, so you know the divine, but how do you know the divine ball? Like, because, you know, I imagine if I grew up in some random village nowhere, like, I could recognize that there was a creative being, but how could I know what that creative being wanted of me, or the way to live life?
How would you know what divine law was? Well, it would be that which you assume about yourself. For example, you assume that it's wrong for you just to go and just cold-blooded kill somebody. Why do not only you, but everybody pretty much agrees about that? Shall I say almost everybody? Because I have heard of some tribes that think of that killing is the highest or ideal. But for, you know, at least 99.99% of people in the world believe that murder is wrong without anybody actually having to tell them that it's wrong. That would be God working in us.
God has given us a conscience, even if we're not a believer yet. There's already a built-in conscience.
Yes, this is what we call conscience. Have you ever broken down the word conscience? Con, science. It means with science, literally. It means it's something that is knowledge or scientific, something that you know that's with you, that you innately know.
Conscience can be seared with a hot iron.
Conscience can be seared. And it's done because we go against our conscience so much that we have a self-defensive mechanism that sears our conscience.
The calculation is not enough. That's why, right, it's not enough. Like, I can know that this building has an architect.
Yeah.
It is, but I don't know this guy.
True. General revelation is not sufficient.
Yeah, it's not sufficient. It's just that I know there is someone out there. So for me to grapple with who is that someone is the thing that will have to, you know?
If general revelation was sufficient, then our job would be done.
Yeah.
All we do is just look around and, yeah, hey, just look at the plants and...
Good enough.
You know, for me, one of the greatest ironies is to walk through the botanic gardens. My wife and I walk through the botanic gardens, you know, two or three times a week. And I find it humorous that there's evolution garden within the botanic garden. Because you know what happens when you walk through evolution garden? There's all kinds of people that they're sweeping. They're sweeping the path there. They're trimming the trees. And I come up to him, I go, hey, this is Evolution Garden. You're not supposed to be doing anything here. You're supposed to let this whole thing evolve. And the workers look at me and they go, what kind of crazy man are you? I'm just kidding. I haven't said this to any of the workers. The workers over there. But I want to. I want to say, this is the Evolution Garden. Why are we devoting so much attention to this?
Care for it, yeah.
You know, why are we caring for it? Just let it go. That's what evolution teaches. And doesn't need any intelligence, doesn't need any effort. But the very fact that they give great attention to maintaining Evolution Garden within the whole Singapore Botanic Gardens disproves the whole concept of evolution. You know? Okay, I don't get it. Enough on that. But we're only stopping here at Romans 1:20. I think you know what happens after that. From verse 21 all the way to the end of the chapter, Paul says that our problem, the problem of humanity, the problem of paganism, is that we are without excuse because we deny what we already know. And when you deny what you innately know, it's only downhill from there. And he says that because we have this starting place, denying which is rational, we end up then becoming idolaters. We end up becoming homosexuals. We end up seeing God delivering us on over to more and more degrading sins. And he says, because they denied, they knew God, they knew of God, but they would not end up really worshiping him. We worship ourselves. So we end up with all these various religions, not through lack of knowledge, but from denying the general revelation that God has given us. I believe that if we respond to the general revelation that God has given us, God will give us more revelation. God will show us more about himself so we can actually come to know this one whose divine nature we share and who has this eternal power, these two things that we actually do know. And we all know of stories like that where people have said, yes, I want to respond to this. That one of them is the Hawaiian Islands, where the king and queen were worshiping the one true God the best they knew, and they prayed that he would send those who would show them more about that. Shortly afterwards, a missionary showed up in Hawaii. And these whole people groups came to know Christ in Hawaii and in other places of the world. There are similar stories, perhaps in your country as well. Well, it's a sad story when you look at what we've got in the Old Testament. We need to get rid of our typewriters, don't you think? Thank God there's a mute button here. But where is it? But anyway, my students who did this presentation like typewriters, I think. So let's compare and contrast the major religions of antiquity, the pagan religions. To do that, there's a little bit of overlap in what we have... Where's a mute button on this? I got my dimmed mute button here. Oh, here's my mute button. This really gets my wife when I do this sort of thing. So, fortunately, she's not here. So, gather information on these religions, compare them, and then consider what we can learn from these. All right. Starting from the beginning, the Sumerian, the Babylonian gods. We've studied already on high god of all. Notice there's a high god here. All right? There's not like three or four. It's not a democracy among the top gods. There's a hierarchy here. So there, the Babylonians believed that one god was higher than all the others. Marduk, as we've studied, ends up becoming the one who ends up conquering them and becoming the high god. But and normally the high god is the one up in the air, like Enlil, for example, lord of the airspace. We saw in the Babylonian flood accounts, he's responsible for the flood and creating man, but he's banished to hell for raping Ninlil. All right, so here's the high god committing immorality and therefore loses his place. Marduk is the upstart god, you might say. Four eyes, four ears, and emits fire from his mouth. And Marduk ends up becoming the strongest of the gods. More than 50 names are given for Marduk. So they obviously have a huge emphasis on Marduk. Bel is one of them. And you'll see some of these appear from one religion over to the other religion. He's called the sun, the majesty of the gods. Well, he was, you know, the son of Enlil. When we get over to the Canaanites, the high god is El in the northern part, like Phoenicia, in the southern part, Dagon, all right? Because Dagon was worshipped by the Philistines. And this Canaanite religion spread throughout the land of Israel, from the Canaanites to many of the other tribes, or many of the other ites. So the Philistines and the others end up also worshiping Baal. Baal ends up being brought on actually into the northern kingdom. And he's the high god, prince of the earth, god of fertility. Watch out. If he's god of fertility, bad stuff's coming. Lord of sky and earth. Does this help to understand 1 Kings 18? 1 Kings 18, Elijah. Elijah is at a contest with the prophets of Baal. The northern kingdom has brought in Baal worship under Ahab and Jezebel. What's the battle about? Is it about, you know, who can throw a spear the farthest? No. It's who can bring fire from the sky, right? Now, don't you think Baal ought to be able to bring fire from the sky? I mean, he's the god of the sky. He's the god of thunder. He's the god of lightning. It's not like we're asking him to do something out of his job description, right? Baal means lord or master or owner, and was the chief deity of the Phoenicians and the Canaanites. But that Baal worship was brought on in to Israel. He wasn't immortal because he kept dying. Well, maybe you could say he is immortal because he kept dying and then he kept coming back to life on an annual basis. What a guy, you know? And worshipped in the high places of Moab. So here's Baal worship from Phoenicia brought all the way across the other side of the Jordan River down into Moab. This ends up becoming more than just a local deity. I mean, there was Baal evangelists all over there in the north. And remember that the Baal cycle was when Moab, the god of death, kills Baal in the winter, but Baal rises in spring. And in the rising, Baal has to have sexual relations with Ashtoreth so that there will be rain that will bring the crops that are harvested in the summer and the fall. But then, Baal gets killed again because it's winter the next year. And then the Baal cycle has to go again. Baal has to rise again. And he has to get together with Ashtoreth. And so we end up with the people wanting to make sure that Baal and Ashtoreth kind of do their thing every spring. All right? So Baal is the man. Mot, which is the Hebrew word for death. There's an interchange, I guess you say, from the words here. Mot in winter is defeated by Baal, or life in the spring. And so we always see Baal depicted with the, you know, with the spear, and he's ready to go get these people. Well, as a result of all this, temple prostitution and sexual fertility rites in the worship help resurrect Baal every spring. So we end up with, if I can think of this from the standpoint of a woman at that time, a woman who would be what we would call a sex slave in the Baal temple. What a horrible, horrible position to be in. To be so powerless as a woman, to think that based on fear, like Juping, like you were saying, this, if I don't give myself to these worshipers in worship of Baal, we're not going to get the rains. And if we don't get the rains, we're not going to get the crops. If we don't have the crops, we're going to die of starvation. And so we end up with this going on as well. We also end up with the most precious of all, which would be babies, offered to Baal. And during worship, live babies were placed on the burning hands of the statue of Baal. I can hardly imagine that from the standpoint of a mother handing over her baby to the priest who would burn her baby alive. You know, you think, for those of us who are parents, you don't even have to be a parent to see how abhorrent this is. There must have been just so much fear for them to do that. Fear for their very, very livelihood. And after dying, these babies were then pushed into a hole underneath. Archaeologists have found underneath some of these statues dozens, or I've heard of even maybe hundreds of infant skeletons, all done because of fear and because of feeling like their very livelihood was at stake. That's a very, very sad thing to think about. Dagon was the high god of the Philistines. It has the D-A-G, Dag, was the word for fish. By the way, we have this debate about Jonah. Was Jonah swallowed by a whale, or was Jonah swallowed by a fish? Right? You've heard of that debate? To be really accurate about it to the Hebrew, we have to say Jonah was swallowed by a dog.
Dog?
Yeah. It was a dog that swallowed Jonah, because the Hebrew word there is dog. D-A-G, which means fish. So Jonah was swallowed by a dog. In other words, not a whale. All right? But some say that Dagon or Dagon actually doesn't come from the word for fish. You'll see in this depiction here that this is a fish head on a man's body, and that is one of the depictions of Dagon, so that's why they would consider that to be the fish. But others say Dagon means grain. And remember, the Philistines were in left stage Israel. They had the flat plains and they had the crops. And so it was a very fertile area for them to be able to grow things. I can't say I know which one. But in any case, the upper torso was a man and the back hip, back half of him was fish. So we have the temples of Dagon at Gaza and other places there in Judges 21, 23. And you know the story of Samson killing more people at his death in the temple of Dagon than it, during his lifetime. When we go to the Egyptians, we see also a pantheon of gods, but there's also at the top a single god, Atum, the All. And we, the Egyptians were really big on putting on the tops of their people various heads of these gods. This is how you can tell which god they're talking about. They have human bodies, and then they'll put like a ram's head or whatever. Atum, for example, was the king of the gods, and you know, understandably so, he had a ram head, right? Because the rams were can ram people. Rams are very, very strong animals. So they picked the high god and put a ram head on top of him. Amun or Amon. Remember the son of Manasseh? Amon? A-M-O-N? The worst king of the southern kingdom, Manasseh, named his son Amon. Here he is ruling over Israel, but he names his son after an Egyptian deity. That's like your pastor having a daughter. Oh, hell, we ever gave birth to Jezebel. Here, come and say hi to Jezebel. You know, I mean, you would kind of like, Pastor, did you just name your daughter Jezebel? Yeah, and here's her brother, Ahab. And like, have you known anybody who's named their kid Ahab? Are you kidding? That's what Manasseh was doing. He was taking the worst of the deities, you know. So anyway, there's a lot in a name, right? We can say, oh, well, names don't really matter, but there's actually quite a bit in a name. So, in fact, during the break, Sheba told me that her name doesn't mean, because I was asking her, Sheba, because I was thinking of Shiva, S-H-I-V-A, not an actually a wonderful Hindu deity. She's not really honorable deity. And she said, no, I'm not Shiva, I'm Sheba.
Sheba.
And it means...
if you Google it...
It's a Christian name.
Yeah.
It's a Christian name, so okay. So that clarified things for me, because I was wondering, is one of my students named after Hindu deity here? No, not so. There's a lot in a name, you know? So we've got these similar gods, really. And notice that each one of them has a high god. Isn't that part of just innate to us all? To even in all these religions that have polytheistic pantheon, they all still believe there was one high god among the pantheon. Whether in Sumer or the Babylonians, An and Anu, or the Canaanites, El and Dagon, there's still the high god. All right, and then we've got all the various other gods among these sort of things. And they were like humans. They had families. They could procreate. They ate. They feasted. They even got drunk. They experienced human feelings of jealousy, anger, lust, etc. Doesn't that just sound like us? Feuds, battle among themselves. And they had varying powers, because they're always trying to have their power go over someone else. But none of them were omnipotent. Among the various deities, none of them had power over all. And that's how we can see the high god actually lose his place, because he's not omnipotent. In Babylon, Marduk ends up taking the place of the high god. They could die, and they could relive again, as we've seen in the case of Baal or Baal. And in many of the depictions, they are portrayed as people with animal parts. Dagon with a human body, a man's body, and a fish tail. Ra, the god of sun, in Egypt has an eagle head, because after all, who flies higher than the eagle? I think from an Egyptian standpoint, it makes sense. Let's put an eagle head on him, because that would talk about Ra. Horus is less. Horus got a hawk head. I think eagles fly higher than hawks, right? An Anubis with a jackal head, or Enlil with horse legs. Yeah. So, question. Of all these various gods, who does not belong here? All right? You know, this is your exam.
Oh.
All right? Who doesn't belong here? Can you tell? The ones who are made in the image of God, not the gods who are made in the image of man, you know? Yeah, this shows you how easy the questions are going to be for the final exam.
Wow.
Much to be said on this, and we've looked at some of this in terms of their beliefs about creation, and I won't get into all the details about all that. Creation often comes about through war, through difficulties. The Great Flood, we've studied that, about Sumer and Babylon and Egyptians. We've seen that actually the flood is talked about, is written about in over 270 cultures of the world, which would attest to the fact that it truly did happen, and the teaching about the flood would have gone down and been passed on generation after generation. In Babylon, it was a result of disagreement among the gods, and the earth was overpopulated, and we end up with the one who survives the flood gains immortality. Kind of a corruption of what you see in actually Genesis 9, where the ones who survive the flood are given, well, the life itself, but they're talked about how sacred life is. So therefore, capital punishment is enacted after the flood. They had their views of life after death, especially the Egyptians buried more people with objects than anybody. They believed in some form of hope in the next life based on works. But the others didn't really have a favorable view of the afterlife. Pagan beliefs with relationships to the gods. Basically, the gods were there to help them provide for their needs and such. The Egyptians were the most moral of them, you might say, but it was still based on fear, because they had this theology of salvation by works. We also have priests and priestesses. What we find, we'll talk about this, we'll have a session on priests in talking about this. So I think I'll skip on over that. Except to say that political rulers assumed to have close contact with the gods, and women's function and special roles in the temple. They all have temples. In fact, the temples look kind of similar. There's a grand architecture depicting the central importance of religion in their life. Whether you're talking about the excavations in Egypt or Sumeria or in Israel, there's a prominent place given to the temple in the town. You certainly see it in Jerusalem. The focal point of Jerusalem was the temple itself. And so that was in accord with what we find among the others. Pagan religion had their rites and rituals. And so the word cult has been applied actually to the Israelite worship as well. But both sexes went to temples not to worship, but to be worshipped. See, if you create a god in your own image, then it's all beneficial to them. And this is a reminder to us to make sure that we don't make our god in our own image, because he's very comfortable that way, you know. We end up with indulging in sexual perversion in worship, adultery, incest, homosexuality, bestiality, to stimulate the deities to engage in sexual acts, to believe to bring out the seasonal cycle. And I find it interesting that you find in Israel the festivals that came throughout the year annually were according to the seasonal cycles of harvest, etc. At the same time that Israel was doing this, the other pagans were also having harvest festivals, but theirs were horribly immoral. I think one of the reasons that God had Israel have the same thing is he wanted to encourage the people, you stay within your own. Don't go to their festival. You're going to have your own festival, harvest festival or whatever, at that same time. It was just depraved. The people just killed for material prosperity. And in their temples, we understand now that these views that we have, old medieval views of, you know, Tower of Babel looking like this, not so, not like that. It's more like the ziggurat that we see in the scales. Nobody's actually dug up something that looks like this. You know, it's not based on archaeology. So, in other words, what common characteristics were true of most, if not all, ancient Near East pagan religions? Give at least two traits. All right, here's your little quiz. So turn to the person next to you, give at least two things that you see that the pagan religions had in common but Israelites did not do. All right, here's your little quiz. For those of you looking ahead, don't look ahead, all right? Two things, they're different. All right, did you get your two? Let's see if you have any of these, all right? Here's the uniqueness of pagan religion. Here's what they did share in common. They were all polytheistic. We'll have a session on that next one. Their gods were sinful. Their sacrifice were blemished. They had offerings, priestesses. Israel was the only one that had only male priests, as far as we know. Local deities, religions of the plains, like left stage, right stage. Their worship was motivated by fear or finances. Every one of them had visual images of their gods. They thought it's so strange that Israel would worship a god and Israel didn't depict the god with some kind of image. Temple prostitutes, they had to care for their gods. Their mythology was acceptable, and there was an overlap between political leaders and their gods. Did you think of something else that's not up here that would be common to them all?
Hierarchy.
Yeah, good. Okay. There's a hierarchy of their gods. I could also put, along with hierarchy, that there was one high god among them all. Right? That would be true. So how is Israel's religion distinct from these other religions of the OT era? So, okay, here's 1 minute for you. Give at least two contrasts. How was Israel unique? You guys, I'm really asking you a logic question, right? If you're thinking, all you have to do is say, well, the opposite of what we just said. Because if they're all polytheistic and Israel's unique, then Israel's the only one that's monotheistic. The only one that says their God is holy. Their priesthood is by genealogy. I should say also male priesthood as well. God is not a local deity. I put a question mark by this one, salvation by faith. I don't know of any other religion that says that salvation was by faith, but certainly is the case for Israel. Were there any genuine miracles of the others? We don't see that. We see mythology. It's more the religion of the desert, getting back into our left stage, right stage theology. No physical depiction of God, I just said. Moral standards of worshipers and leaders. There you go. You can't just have immoral people being their leaders in Israel. They did it, but that was against what God wanted. They had a covenant relationship with God. God himself initiated relationship with Israel. So it was God initiated. They couldn't manipulate God. And they were male priests only. Do you see how unique Israel's religion was? I mean, I say this because there are so many scholars and archaeologists, they dig up stuff and they find a point of commonality between Israel and the other pagan religions. So they say, well, Israel just came out of those. Well, of course you're going to find some points of commonality. The temples look similar. They both had sacrifices and priests, etc. But that's to ignore these huge, huge distinctions between all of them. And you could do, I'm not going to show you the Hungry Ghost Festival, but the Hungry Ghost has a thing on that. So anyway, how did your readings today help you appreciate Judaism? And I hope it helped you aid your own walk with the Lord. And to put it in perspective for today, we will see similarities between Christianity and Buddhism. We will see similarities between Christianity and Hinduism. Why should we be surprised that there's similarities? I'd be surprised if there were no similarities. We are all people made in the image of God. But when you look deeper, you will see these things. Israel was influenced by paganism. I'm talking about pure Judaism today. I'm talking about not what they got caught up in, you know. We know what good theology is, we know what the biblical way is, but we also end up getting caught up in doing things otherwise. So we should beware of syncretism today. My wife is she's very, very more attuned to this than she was earlier. For 8 years, she was a library at a Christian school here. And she, now that she knows what she knows, she wished she hadn't allowed certain books to be read by children where there was this sort of syncretism. We even have the World Council of Churches praying to the goddess Sophia. The wisdom. Sophia is the Hebrew or the Greek word for wisdom. And so we have actually some of these councils of churches praying to Greek deities. I'm moving on into New Testament backgrounds now. But basically, God-centeredness versus self-indulgence is the idea here. The Lord said in Exodus 23, "Pay attention to all that I've said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips." If you even mention the names of those gods, you could be mentioning them with a sense of admiration. It's better just to not even say their names, is what God told them to do. And that's a good word. That's a good word for us as well.